from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. There's no question that Japan will contend with the aftermath of the Fukushima nuclear disaster for many years. But will it also have a long-lasting impact on the future of nuclear energy all around the globe? 20% of the electricity generated in the United States comes from nuclear power. And proponents like President Obama believe that because nuclear plants produce far less carbon than their coal-powered equivalents, nuclear power is a key part of our clean energy future. So should the U.S. build more nuclear plants in the future to reduce its carbon footprint? Or does the Fukushima experience make the risks of nuclear power all too evident? We'll debate that question next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The aftermath of Japan's ongoing struggle to contain the Fukushima nuclear disaster has also prompted a reconsideration of nuclear power itself all around the world. In recent years, nuclear power has gained a number of adherents because it emits far less carbon than coal or gas-fired plants. This week, in fact, President Obama repeated his belief that nuclear power can and should still play an important role in contending with the global threat of climate change. But the Fukushima disaster has also raised a chorus of concern about the safety of nuclear power. Nuclear power is not the answer to global warming, said the co-founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility, Dr. Helen Caldicott. It is, she said, instead a destroyer of worlds. This morning on Forum, we take up the debate with two environmentalists who view the value and danger of nuclear power in very different ways. Joining us, Michael Schellenberger. He is the president of the Breakthrough Institute, which is a research and policy institute focused on clean energy. He's also the author of co-author of Breakthrough. Michael Schellenberger, good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to have you here. David Hamilton joins us as well from Washington, where he is the director of global warming and energy programs for the Sierra Club. Dave Hamilton, thanks for being with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Well, happy to have you both here and to take a look at this because so much has been written and thought about and talked about since Fukushima happened 3 weeks ago. So let's begin with that, if we might, Michael Schellenberger, because we always try to pull lessons out of events like this. What do you take from what we've learned so far from what happened at Fukushima?
Well, there's a lot to learn. I think it's helpful to have some context around it. I mean, the first thing you realize with Fukushima is that this is at least the second worst nuclear accident in the history of the nuclear power, second only to Chernobyl. You know, where 60 people have died so far, and the United Nations says up to 4,000 could die. So far, Fukushima, we have no reported deaths, but obviously you have
the 4,000 could die eventually
Chernobyl. Because of cancer related to the Chernobyl accident. In the case of Fukushima, we so far have no confirmed deaths, a couple of reported injuries, you know, huge evacuation, which obviously is very troubling, and concerns around radiation. I think as context, when I say it's the second worst nuclear power disaster, that's not to say it's one of the worst industrial disasters. It's not. It's not even one of the worst energy disasters. I mean, we had 25 energy disasters last year, all of which killed dozens of people, mostly in coal mines, all of which outrank Fukushima in terms of death toll. And in terms of industrial accidents, obviously you have Bhopal, which killed 4,000 people. And you have the disaster itself, where 20,000 Japanese are presumed to be dead. And it would, you know, interestingly enough, when we were kind of looking at other energy systems that were affected, you had a dam go out in Fukushima that washed away 1,800 homes. A lot of people don't realize this. Unknown number of dead. You had high-speed rail trains that are missing, and the people in them, 400 people presumed dead. So you have big death tolls from a whole set of things that are actually not associated with nuclear. And yet, obviously, for a set of different reasons, we are much more focused on the nuclear plant itself.
Let me get your take on this as well, Dave Hamilton. You heard Michael Schellenberger's argument that we've in some ways gravitated too much to what happened in Fukushima. Put it in your own set of context.
I think it's important to note that we don't know yet what the extent of Fukushima is. You know, the idea that we're going to kind of take stock of it now and put it in context and, you know, file it while it's going on and while, you know, you have reactor water they're trying to deal with. You've got cesium showing up 40 kilometers away. For us to say this is what Fukushima was is a little premature.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you then the broader question about taking Chernobyl, where we do have some value of time. It's been 25 years since Chernobyl. Estimates, as Michael Schellenberger was saying, are some estimate even more in terms of up to perhaps 10,000 people might die of cancer because of Chernobyl. But still in all, as Frank von Hippel argued in the New York Times this week, the physicist from Princeton, that many people, 10,000 people, die each year because of air pollution from coal-fired plants. So given that context, again, I just would like you to focus in, as if you would, on how you see the danger, the health danger of nuclear power.
Well, I think you have to look at the fact that Chernobyl, you know, it was in a town, but it was fairly far away from a major metropolitan area as compared to something like Indian Point, which is within 50 miles of New York City and in a very, very densely populated area. So I think, you know, there are a lot of dimensions around this. There are what is the evacuation plan? What is the way humans have historically dealt with disasters? I mean, it wasn't a nuclear disaster, but you can hearken back to Hurricane Katrina as to, you know, there was no central authority to, really address what needed to be done after the disaster. There was, you know, very slow response because of a variety of factors. And we have not really addressed, what we would do in the event of a disaster. So I think the safety part is part reactor safety, but it's also part, societal organizational structure.
And does that mean from your point of view, Dave Hamilton, that there hasn't been a nuclear plant built in this country for 25 years. None are likely to be built anytime soon. But do you take from all of this and the concern you have about evacuation, as you just described, from a plant that's near New York City, do you then think that there should be a moratorium placed on any future nuclear power plant development in the U.S.?
We think that, you know, for once, Congress and policymakers should orient themselves toward determining what energy sources are in the greatest public benefit, what can we deliver most quickly, most cheaply, most safely, and how do we go about doing that? And, you know, I've been around Washington for 20 years, and the way they make energy policy is they put together a bunch of stuff that the industries want, and there's a little bit for nuclear and a little bit for coal and a little bit for utilities and a little bit for oil, and then they sprinkle a little efficiency and renewables on the top to try to make it balanced, and that's how we do energy policy. And then all the big guys support the bill, and then it passes.
Dave Hamilton. Go ahead. Finish up, please.
So that's what I think we need to get serious about pursuing renewables, pursuing efficiency in a way that we haven't even broached yet.
Dave Hamilton is the Director of Global Warming and Energy Programs for the Sierra Club. I want to get to that larger debate because that is the key question in a moment. But first, Michael Schellenberger, before we do that, on this safety question and Dave Hamilton's interesting point that you have in this country plants like the one near New York City that are in a very different circumstance than Chernobyl was and therefore pose that much greater a danger.
Right. I think there's a couple of things that are really important to look at here. First of all, this is a heavily studied issue. And we found two peer-reviewed studies, very good studies, that compared energy production deaths in different kinds of energy production. It's Cruet, 1998, also 2002. And he found that years of life lost per terawatt hour of energy, in other words, per unit of energy. For coal, it's 138. For oil, it's 359. For gas, it's 42. For solar PV, it's 58. For nuclear, it's 25. So it's so the research is quite established on this. These are very good German researchers, independent researchers.
So those are give me the context of that again. Those are lives
these
lost.
These are lives
per
lost in the through the energy production of these different energy sources.
Okay.
Now, I have to say, as somebody that was I had been anti-nuclear really most of my life, most of my adult life, certainly ever since I was a kid, grew up, really working for and and believing in the anti-nuclear cause. And I have to say, I used to think that there was some sort of secret information or there were things that people weren't telling us about radiation. I used to have a very kind of, I thought maybe the governments was covering up things. You know, and now increasingly, especially after dealing with climate issues, I do look to the United Nations research agencies, and I have confidence in them. I do not think they're corrupt. I do not think they're lying. And when the United Nations, it's the UN Environment Program, the World Health Organization, all, you know, 15 different government agencies, United Nations agencies looked at Chernobyl, I was shocked at what I found. You know, a total of 60 deaths so far. And this was from the worst. I mean, this is a place that had no containment dome. In a Stalinist society where they let the kids drink the radiated milk rather than making them throw it out, and you have that many deaths. You have, in contrast, you have 2 million air pollution deaths a year.
So would your argument be that even if something Chernobyl-like or Fukushima-like happened at the site that Dave Hamilton was describing, Indian Point, near New York City, that there's no way that the resulting aftermath could in any way wreak the kind of havoc that other energy generating systems already do on an ongoing basis?
I mean, I would, you know, I'm humble enough in our knowledge, our lack of knowledge about the future that I would never make a blanket statement like that. I think that there are, you know, obviously we all think there are black swans, there are things you can't expect. But what we have is a 60-year track record of this technology. And, you know, I think if you're going to suggest, I think that people misassess this risk because there's things about nuclear that are particularly scary. People think that it leads to nuclear weapons. It doesn't. People think that the waste is sort of goes all over the place. I mean, I heard Helen Caldicott just making really weaving science fiction. It felt like a Hollywood movie, the stuff that they would talk about. And of course, there have been Hollywood movies based on ridiculous ideas like a meltdown traveling all the way through
China
the earth
syndrome.
To China.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and I understand it. Radiation is something that people don't understand. It seems very scary. But the truth is actually we've been studying radiation for 60 years. We've got great data on it from medical research, from people who live at higher radiation areas. There's an overwhelming body of data here. And so to believe that nuclear poses a risk beyond what the science says means you have to actually not believe in the basic science of this, or you have to believe that these agencies are lying.
You seem to also really be making an underlying point here, which is that even if you live in the Bay Area, you really ought to do your homework. You really ought to look into this and not just sort of kind of automatically think, oh, nuclear power is bad.
I mean, I'll speak personally. I mean, I regret not having looked at this earlier. I mean, I'm 39 and I've been in the environmental movement my whole life. And honestly, like, you know, you don't need to be an expert in nuclear physics. You just need to be able to read some United Nations documents. You need to be able to read the basic information. And, I think it's hard. I think people, I know from arguing with my family, it's hard for people to change their minds. But I think if you have any open mind at all, spend a couple of hours really reading independent, neutral sources on this stuff.
Maybe before we close, we'll ask you each to give your homework assignments for people here in the Bay Area. Michael Schallenberger is president of the Breakthrough Institute. Dave Hamilton, a brief response, if you would, on that point that Michael is articulating. And then I want to move to this question of whether or not what nuclear power can give us in terms of quote-unquote clean energy is worth some of the risks that we've been describing. But any response to what Michael was articulating?
Yeah, I think when you look at how some of the international standards are stacked, I mean, radiation standards are done according to reference man. And reference man is 154 pounds, 5'7", in his 20s. A woman who gets the same radiation dose is about 50 times more likely to get cancer. An infant who, basically drinks milk with iodine contamination is 70% more likely to get thyroid cancer. So I think the way we do a lot of this stuff is not necessarily focused on the populations that are most vulnerable.
Can you put those numbers in any kind of clearer context? Because it's always tricky when you say things like it increases the risk by 70%. Because it could be, for example, that the risk is 1 in 1,000 and you have this contaminated milk and it goes to 1.7 per 1,000. That's a 70% increase, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's very likely.
I think that, you know, I'm not a doctor. And I am quoting statistics from a nuclear physicist, but
okay, well,
I don't know exactly what the odds are. So.
It's like to believe that the United Nations Environment Program, the World Health Organization, are getting the science of radiation wrong, and that they are putting lives at risk. I mean, what is the basis for believing that? I mean, we as environmentalists over the years have really come to trust the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Because it's a good group. It's a scientific-based group. I disagree with some of the policy recommendations. I quibble with this and that. But to suggest that these United Nations agencies are looking at these questions of radiation and they're downplaying the threat and putting pregnant women and children at risk, that feels like fear-mongering to me. And it feels like you're cherry-picking. You kind of go find a nuclear physicist who tells you what you want to hear, and you just want to dismiss this huge body of scientific literature.
Dave Hamilton.
I'm really just responding to a lot of the things that I've seen lately about saying, well, radiation really isn't a problem. It's really not a risk. You know, you get the same thing as a chest X-ray. But all I'm saying, my only point is that different populations are at different risk of radiation.
Well, let's...
So
let's,
I'm not... I'm
point point taken,
I'm trying
Dave
to marginalize
Hamilton.
The United Nations.
Right. Point taken. Let's move, though, to something that you both have deep concerns about, which is trying to contend with the threat of climate change and global warming. President Obama this week, Dave Hamilton, said, "Those of us concerned about climate change know that nuclear power can make a significant contribution to the climate change question." That's been the argument in recent years, that nuclear power can make a difference here because it just emits so much less CO2 than coal-fired or even gas-fired power plants. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, there have been a variety of studies from DOE researchers, from Google, from a number of bodies that basically say we don't have to have a huge new investment in nuclear power to roughly get to a Hansen-esque kind of 80%, and this is the United States, this is not the world, but to get to an 80% reduction in CO2 by 2050. So there are, I think, the question is how fast are you going to put your pedal to the metal on developing renewable energy sources and maximizing efficiency?
So your argument would be not that nuclear power doesn't reduce CO2 emissions. There are other paths up the mountain. There are other ways to get there.
Yeah, and we've been talking here as if safety is the only concern with nuclear power, when in fact there's cost and there is, you know, Michael doesn't believe there's proliferation problems, but in the reprocessing, in countries where there is reprocessing in a uranium enrichment supply chain, there have been disappearances of large amounts of plutonium.
Go ahead, please.
There is, that pesky little matter of a long-term waste solution.
Yeah. All those issues.
All these things combined to make it a less desirable option.
No, I know all those issues are key, and I want to get to all of them, both the cost and the weapons concern as well as the waste. They're all key questions, and we will get to them. But I just want to stay, if I might, on the climate change question for a moment. You heard Dave Hamilton argue, Mike Schellenberger, that there are other ways to get there, that there are other ways to get to that, and that we shouldn't, even though nuclear power does, in fact, put out less carbon, there are other alternatives.
Yeah, so more context is needed. The world, according to the UN scenarios, and forecasting is always a difficult job, but the world is likely to double or triple the amount of energy it consumes between now and 2050. Everyone thinks, well, that's overpopulation or whatever. It's actually mostly from very poor people coming to live to basic modern European standards of living. So we're going to consume, you know, 2 to 3 times more energy. At the same time, if we want to stabilize emissions and stabilize climate at whether 450, 350, doesn't really matter, you have to cut emissions in half by 2050, and you have to zero them out by the end of the century. What that requires in terms of new clean energy, low carbon energy, is the equivalent of one gigawatt nuclear power plant per day. Or if you don't like nuclear, that would require 9 wind farms every day the size of the Keep wind farm that we've been advocating to get built, that they've been trying to build for a decade, and they can't, you know, it's very difficult to build. Obviously, that's not going to happen. The truth is, we're not going to build a new nuclear plant a day, nor build three or build nine wind farms a day. So you have to have fairly radical technological innovation. In terms of cost, right now, solar PV is very expensive in comparison to basically everything else. It's about five times more expensive than gas. We ran the numbers comparing the cost of building the German solar panels to the Japanese nuclear. It would be five times more expensive to produce the same amount of power from solar panels that you would get in the Japanese plant. So,
but the political reality is, and we'll come back to the cost question, but the political reality is there haven't been nuclear power plants built in this country for 25 years. They're not likely to be any time in the next decade or two. And if you will both agree that the clock is ticking in terms of climate change, don't we have to do what Dave Hamilton is arguing and move to things for which there is more political support, be that a greater investment in solar, wind, et cetera?
Well, I mean, the first thing you have to understand is that the United States wasn't moving towards building a lot of nuclear before Fukushima. It's still got two nuclear plants set to be built. You know, huge number of plants are being planned in China and India. Those are going to go forward. Those countries need power, and frankly, the risks of and the consequences, the health consequences of keeping people in really dire poverty are always higher than those risks from nuclear. In the case of the United States, you have to remember that right now nuclear power, built nuclear power is cheaper than built coal, okay? And in France, nuclear power is the cheapest electricity in Europe. It's so cheap they sell it for a profit every year to their neighbors. In China, the Chinese executives say that nuclear power is cheaper than coal in China. They can't build nuclear fast enough because they don't have enough nuclear scientists and engineers. So if you want to, if the issue is, you know, so I'm all for, I mean, we've been huge advocates of spending big money to invest in R&D and solar, electric batteries, all sorts of things to get the breakthroughs that you need so that they can compete with nuclear energy and with fossil. But I think if you really want to start, we were challenged on this because we've been advocates of making clean energy a lot cheaper. And we had various people be like, look, nuclear is already a lot cheaper, is already competitive with fossil. The question is, we probably need to do both. We have to both invest in innovation and deploy a lot of nuclear.
Michael Schellenberger is president of the Breakthrough Institute. We're coming up on a break, but just a brief response, Dave Hamilton, before we do that. And then we'll return and we'll get into the waste and weapons issues as well on this cost question. Nuclear is hugely expensive to build. There's no debate about that. He's arguing, though, that once it's built, it winds up producing energy at a comparatively cheap rate.
As long as it continues to be subsidized. I mean, there was just a study that was done for the Union of Concerned Scientists basically saying that embedded subsidies for existing plants are about 7 cents a kilowatt hour. So when you look at what solar is going to be, what solar subsidies are, what wind subsidies are, you know, nuclear ends up being subsidized beyond everything else. And, you know, is only cheap as built because it gets through this thing. And the subsidies they've lopped on in the 2005 energy bill and the loan guarantees that we continue to see coming down the pike, you know, the high-end estimate for subsidies is 11 cents a kilowatt hour.
And let me hold you there.
The cost to be on top of that.
Yeah, let me hold you there, and then we'll come back. Dave Hamilton, Director of Global Warming and Energy Programs for the Sierra Club. He joins us along with Michael Schellenberger, President of the Breakthrough Institute. We'll talk more and when we come back, and we'd like to hear from you as well. You can join us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. What do you feel about nuclear power? Is that part of the answer to our concerns over global warming, or are the threats too great for us to consider that? Join our conversation. We'll take your calls after this. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. In the aftermath of the Fukushima disaster in Japan, there's been a lot of discussion about the future of nuclear power in this country and around the world, and that's our focus during this hour of Forum. Michael Schellenberger joins us. He's president of the Breakthrough Institute, which is a research and policy institute advocating clean energy. And Dave Hamilton joins us as well. He's director of Global Warming and Energy Programs for the Sierra Club. We'd like to hear from you as well during our conversation. Here's the number, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Do you support greater use of nuclear power, or does the Fukushima experience make you all the more adamantly opposed? Have you changed your mind? This is a difficult issue for many people who come to terms with nuclear power in one way, perhaps, and then perhaps might be prompted to think about it differently. Have you changed your mind on this question? If so, why? We'd like to get that point of view in our program, too. Here's the number again, 866-733-6786. Keep trying. If our lines are full, as they are at the moment, we'll take our first call in a moment. Before we do, though, let's touch on the waste issue. Because, Michael Schellenberger, this has been a long time topic, whether or not we should build the facility at Yucca Mountain in Nevada. And part of the concern out of Fukushima was that the radiation came from spent fuel rods that were being kept at the plant and the water evaporating and all of that. Isn't that something that people should be rightfully concerned about?
Yeah, and before answering that, let me just correct something that Dave said. There's been studies done of subsidies for energy. Renewables receive 7.4 times more subsidies per unit of energy than fossil. Nuclear receives loan guarantees. That's not actually the same thing. And so it's a bit odd to hear somebody that's been a big advocate of solar and wind condemning subsidies. We basically subsidize all energy, including fossil, oil, and gas. So,
but and you believe those subsidies ought to exist?
We actually support increasing a particular kind of subsidy, which is a subsidy for innovation. We think we should stop subsidizing old technologies, whether they're solar or nuclear, and we should be doing contracts like the military does, military procurement contracts, for advanced technologies. That's the public good we should be buying. I mean, I think on the waste issue, just I'll touch on that. I mean, you know, look, the thing about the waste is the first thing you have to understand about it is there's just not very much of it. When you have carbon waste, it creates a global climate risk that is incalculable, literally. I mean, it's like there's efforts, you know, the IPCC does efforts to calculate it, but the risks associated with it are very difficult to calculate. In contrast, nuclear waste, all of the nuclear waste that's been produced in the United States can fit onto 2 football fields in dry cask storage.
Would you be comfortable having one of those football fields next door to you in Albany?
Absolutely. I would absolutely feel comfortable with it. In fact, I grew up near a nuclear plant. When I was a kid, I went and visited it. I made fun of it because I was anti-nuclear. But no, I would. You know, and the truth is that one of the most exciting things that's going on in all energy technology, forget whether you're a solar partisan or you love nuclear, one of the most exciting things is that there are nuclear technologies being developed that use the waste as fuel. This is what Bill Gates is inventing in. This is what Nathan Myhrvold, very good engineer at Microsoft or from Microsoft, has been developing. You know, the reality is all of the lifetime waste from one person, if you had all of your electricity coming from nuclear, would fit in a single 2-liter bottle. That's manageable waste. I just think that this waste concern in the context of every other major risk around energy production is completely overblown.
Dave Hamilton, join in on that. Would you be comfortable with that football field of nuclear waste next door to you? If not, why not? Put that in context with the danger of global climate change.
I mean, you've heard this for a long time where people say, well, look, we're going to solve the waste problem. Just trust us. We're going to solve the waste problem, and it's going to be much better. And we're open to seeing when the waste problem is solved. When you've got the technologies that reduce half-lives of isotopes, when you've got solutions to these problems, we hate nuclear forever no matter what happens for the rest of time. This is faced with the situation we're looking at now. You know, even 5 years ago, you had the industry crowing about inherently safe fourth-generation reactors. And we're not there yet. We don't have that. Even the AP100 and the EPR that are the most advanced reactor designs that we're seeing now are kind of generation 2+. So we haven't really solved those macro problems.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Dave Hamilton, about the we're not there yet factor, because that's so central in a lot of ways to this. Stuart Brand, famed environmentalist, makes the argument that it's okay if we're not there yet. If we can store it safely for a couple hundred years, that's okay. And a couple hundred years from now, people will, in fact, have figured out. Meanwhile, the clock is ticking on global climate change, and we ought to sort of have our eyes on the prize.
Unfortunately, for people, Sierra Club members and others who live around nuclear plants who don't kind of have the same level of trust that Stuart Brand does, that doesn't end up being a satisfactory answer. When it comes to comparing the alternatives or what are we going to invest in and how are we going to make our way to a lower carbon future?
I have to say, I think actually, while they may be a minority, I think there's a fair number of Sierra Club members that could actually understand the risk comparison here between the risk of some nuclear waste in dry cask storage versus global warming
versus
2 million air pollution deaths a year. I mean, the idea that it's really pick your waste. I mean, creating solar panels creates a lot of waste and pollution. So what waste do you want?
Dave Hamilton, brief response. And then I want to hear from our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, we're a democratic organization. We our policy is made by our volunteers. In the ranks of our volunteers are nuclear physicists, our engineers, are a whole lot of a whole lot of very technical, very qualified people who, you know, and there has been, you know, no outcry in the Sierra Club membership to reverse our policy on nuclear power.
Let's hear what our listeners think and whether or not they're changing their view on this subject or not. Harvey joins us first in Berkeley. Harvey, go ahead.
Hi. Well, when the gentleman mentioned that solar is five times more expensive, he didn't mention what we call externalities. Externalities are, number one, nuclear power plants use billions of gallons of water in the production of nuclear energy, and that's a general loss to us, especially in California, where we have severe water shortages. Number two, fish. Billions, while these nuclear power plants need water to cool them down, they suck in billions of fish and their larvae and other animal life. And every year, because there's over 100 nuclear power plants, that's 100 billions of fish. And this is playing into our food stocks, our fish food stocks. And at the same time, these nuclear power plants, of which there are over 100 in America and way more in the world, are actually heating up the world itself. When they use the water, they dump the water back into the lakes and rivers at 20 degrees hotter. This is part of our global warming problem. The world is hottest on.
All right, Harvey, thanks. No, it's an important question. And along with that, I'm going to let you respond, Michael Schellenberger, but Mark sort of chimes in with part of the argument that Harvey is making, is that you're not taking into account the entire impact of nuclear. When you think about the mining that goes on, the refining, the generation that's involved with that there's a lot of carbon that gets emitted during that entire process. So both Mark and Harvey are making the argument there's a lot of ripples here that you're not factoring into your argument.
That's actually not the case, by the way, that if you do a full process analysis, and it's been done and it's in scientific literature, the amount of carbon that is created to produce a nuclear plant per unit of energy is less than to create solar PV. Okay, so that's the first thing. And again, readers, I appreciate that folks that have been anti-nuclear their whole life aren't exactly open to this, but I encourage you to do your own research on it. What's causing global warming is not hot water coming out of nuclear reactors. It's greenhouse gas forcings creating a warmer world. That's not controversial. And in terms of land impact, I mean, you have to remember that the nuclear plant takes up about a third of a square mile. An equal-sized wind farm has to cover 200 square miles. A solar farm has to cover 50 square miles. So if you want to talk about externalities, consider that if you want to get with the power that Japan is planning to get from nuclear power by mid-century, you have to cover half of Japan in nuclear panels. Mm. You're going to get externalities.
Nuclear panels? You mean solar panels?
Yeah, so I'm sorry, solar panels. The reality is living on Earth has consequences. And the idea that, I mean, nuclear guy who says that they've got the perfectly safe plant, that's just as ridiculous as Amory Lovin saying that he can design a society of small-powered community energy that is immune to I mean, living on Earth has unintended consequences, and so the question is, which unintended consequences would you rather have?
Let's hear from Zach next in San Francisco. Zach, go ahead.
Hey there, thanks. I was going to say, I was very anti-nuclear power until this whole Fukushima thing happened, at which point I started doing a lot more research on it. And, you know, at this point, I've completely turned around. When you take into consideration both the CO2 impact and the mercury impact that is caused by coal-fired plants, which is, you know, America's main power source at this point, it's a lot more dangerous and destructive to the world and the ecosystems than nuclear power. And, you know, the solutions, the Bill Gates was working on spent fuel system. I really highly suggest all the listeners go and watch the TED Talk that Bill Gates gave on that. It's a real solution that, you know, basically we've got all the spent fuel that we could ever need if this works. The impact is so small. It's so local, the nuclear impact, as opposed to the mercury and the CO2 impact of, let's face it, America's main power source, which is coal, which is really dirty.
Zach, thanks.
So
thanks
everyone, for, yep. Thank you.
Thanks for the observation. Dave Hamilton, a response.
Well, it puts the Sierra Club in a place where I got to agree with Michael that there is nothing that is, you know, a free lunch. You know, our primary campaign is really addressing coal and the impacts of coal, so that you know, I can't really argue with both the global warming impact and the health impacts of what we see as problems with fossil fuels as well. So I, you know, the, you know, these are tough choices, and you know, we will root on, you know, real innovation and real solutions to these problems.
Catherine in Sacramento is next. Catherine, go ahead.
Yes, hello. I was here when we unadopted Rancho Seco nuclear power plant, and we're actually planning to build a second one. And I looked up the records just recently to see what that decision was made on, and it was made on the basis of cost.
Mm-hmm.
Would either of you like to talk about the subsidy, not simply the subsidy to the plant, but the fact, as I remember it, if I'm correct, that no nuclear power plant has ever been privately insured, that we're picking up the cost of insurance. Another issue that comes to mind is that we're very suspicious of Iran and their nuclear refinements because we say they're going to build weapons with them. And what about the security issues of transporting any of these materials?
Catherine, thanks. We'll get an answer on your cost question first, and then let's touch on the weapons issue because that comes up a lot. Dave Hamilton?
It's a great point because, you know, at this point, as we look at reactors going forward, Wall Street's just saying no thanks, and they've been saying no thanks for years. And it was interesting to know that when trying to negotiate the credit subsidy fee for loan guarantees, both Constellation and NRG pulled back from their nuclear projects, and their stock shot up. We have a situation where loan guarantees have the taxpayers holding the bag for the financial risk. The Price-Anderson Act, which I think is what you were mentioning, is that after a very small level, the taxpayer is on the hook for the cost of a nuclear accident. And if the thing does great and makes a huge profit, the investors walk away with it.
With all due respect, this is a double standard. In other words, for environmentalists, there's no complaints about the high level of subsidization for renewables, which again is 7.4 times higher for renewables than for fossil. In the case of nuclear, it has always been capital intensive, and the new designs, the newer, safer, better designs, are always going to come in more expensive. When you get the plants built, as France has done, as China is doing, the cost, including the United States, shows up lower than coal. So these are the basic facts.
But look at the EPR in Finland. It's like 1986 all over again. It's 4 years, you know, behind schedule and 100% over budget.
Well, and so it's like
as if you actually know what it's going to cost.
Hey, you know what? The thing is, we've been trying to get Cape Wind built for years. It's also way behind. I mean, you're cherry picking. In order to make the case that somehow nuclear is uniquely,
I'm going to hold you guys. I'm going to hold you guys on this issue because I want to respond to Catherine's other question, because that always bubbles up in this, which is the weapons question. Don't we have to be careful about that, Michael Schellenberger?
Look, you have to understand this. You don't build nuclear power to get nuclear weapons. If you want a nuclear weapon, you go do the things you need to do to get a nuclear weapon. It is not the case that nations find themselves with nuclear power and they're like, oh, hey, what the heck? You know, we've got this nuclear power. Let's go create a weapon. When you pursue nuclear power as a nation, you invite in United Nations inspectors. When you want to create a weapon, you kick the inspectors out and you do what Iran is doing, which is that you build the centrifuges in order to get the weapons-grade material.
And are you also saying that the technology is just different, that you once a nuclear power plant is built, you can't just sort of scoop up that material and turn it into a bomb?
Well, the point – it's all – there's – nuclear physics is nuclear physics. So I'm not going to say that there's like – you know, it's still nuclear technologies. The difference is that if you get nuclear power now as a nation, you have United Nations inspectors who come in and make sure that it's safe. It's actually one of the great United Nations successes of the post-war era.
And Dave Hamilton, just a quick response on the weapons concern.
I think the concern remains in countries that are pursuing reprocessing, the fact that you do actually make material that can be refined into weapons-grade material. And in cases in this decade, you know, fairly large quantities of that material have been lost or disappeared or that we don't really know about. So I'm not saying that because you have nuclear power, you're going to get nuclear proliferation, but there are weak points in the system that we need to make sure don't get exploited.
It actually works in the reverse. I mean, France goes and develops a nuclear weapon after World War II because they're tired of being victimized by Germany. Then they go and build their nuclear program in response to the oil shocks of the 70s. And incidentally, there's really only
that France is trying to build a bomb out of its nuclear program.
But my point is actually that the association that I used to have, and I think a lot of environmentalists have, is that nuclear power is a stepping stone to a weapon. That is not the case. In fact, what we often find is that the weapon comes first, then they get the power. And we've also seen 10% of our electricity in the United States is from decommissioned nuclear warheads.
Are you arguing, Michael Schellenberger, that one way to prevent nuclear proliferation would be to allow the safe development of nuclear power plants, which is governed and inspected by the United Nations?
Absolutely. That's the view of the United Nations. That's the view of international energy experts.
Let's get to another question. We've had a number of calls about this and emails as well, and it has to do with something called thorium reactors. And to tell you the truth, I'm not entirely sure what it is, but Paul's going to ask about it. Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm a physician and actually interested in nuclear physics and the thorium reactors, which have been largely neglected basically since the uranium industry got going and the United States decided to support uranium enrichment for bomb purposes. We have lots more thorium in Nevada than we ever had uranium. And that whole development of nuclear power from thorium appears to be much safer. I'd like you to comment on that, please.
Thank you. Thanks for the call, Paul. Michael Schellenberger, and then Dave.
I mean, amen to that. I mean, I think first of all, I'm fairly agnostic about. I think that we should have a robust federal energy investment program on the order of $30 to $50 billion a year. Right now, we have about $4 billion. There's no reason to continue to subsidize old plant construction. There's no reason to keep subsidizing old solar panel production. Thorium is one possible design. I've also had many a climate scientist tell me that it's got to be integral fast reactors. I've had other people, emphasize the small modular reactors, gas-cooled pebble bed reactors. I mean, there's a lot of different next-generation designs that are all a lot safer and frankly, have the potential to be much, much cheaper.
By the way, if you want to read more about the thorium reactor and other new forms of nuclear power options, the January 2010 issue of Wired magazine goes into that in some detail. Do you find that at all reassuring, Dave Hamilton, or no?
We're looking for the delivery of the innovation. So it's at this point our policy doesn't distinguish between basic light water reactors and thorium reactors, but it's probably, it's something we would certainly be open to looking into and we'll take a closer look at.
Timothy writes in, could someone address the question of accumulated radioactive waste? If we build more and more nuclear power plants, there will undoubtedly be more accidents and there will be waste produced in every plant all over the world for years to come. Some of the waste and accidental releases have extremely long half-lives. It doesn't go away. Michael Schellenberger, you talked about that actually, in fact, the amount isn't that great, but that's the concern you hear a lot.
Yeah, I think this is why nuclear in particular is so frightening to people, is that I think people have a sense it's the longevity of the waste. They think that it's going to have sort of unknown health impacts, when in fact, You know, in fact, the health impacts are actually really well quantified. There's a robust scientific literature on it. I mean, I gave the set of numbers on it. People should do their own homework on it. You know, again, you're looking at, it's like, I'm not going to sit here and say that nuclear waste is not a problem. It is a problem that we manage, and we probably need to manage it better. And we need to continue to manage it well. But in comparison to the carbon waste in the atmosphere, in comparison to the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, in comparison to the oil spills, how about just the destruction of the Appalachian Mountains? I mean, that's what you get with coal, is you get mountains removed and then the rivers having waste dumped into them, including some of it quite radioactive.
People want to talk more about this issue, though, of waste, and we'll get one more listener call on it before we move on to something else. Ashok in New Hampshire, go ahead.
Hi. I think my question was similar to the one that the earlier person had, which is, it seems to me that with the Fukushima nuclear plant, even though there was no meltdown, there's significant contamination of the surrounding ocean water, and radioactive iodine has shown up as far away as Tokyo. It seems to me that the risks of the waste and managing the waste have been downplayed by comparing it to the catastrophic problems that coal energy and oil energy pose, but it really is not a problem with a solution. So,
yeah.
So on the one hand, yes, coal is bad, but it seems like nuclear is just as bad, and it doesn't make sense to necessarily rush into it with eyes wide open, so to speak.
Ashok, thanks for the call. And Dave Hamilton, chime in on that too, because that seems to be the theme of a number of comments that we're getting. Robert writes in that my problem with nuclear is that when there are the inevitable accidents, the damage lasts so long it might as well last forever. So the concern that people are voicing is, yes, we understand that coal isn't the greatest thing in the world either, but the potential danger here and the longevity of that danger is that much more adverse. Is that your essential viewpoint as well?
Yeah, I mean, the half-life of plutonium is 24,000 years, so that's when it degrades by half. It is, you know, I think a lot of people, and I feel this way in some respect, and the wonk in me, you know, tries to dismiss it, but you know, if you try to think of 24,000 years and how we have to babysit this stuff for that, you know, that kind of period of time, you know, the rise and fall of empires, wars, terrorism, technical innovation, acts of God, you know, how do you actually control over that period of time? You know, the thing about nuclear power is it's an extremely high demanding level of proficiency, and it stays that way.
The trick,
fundamentally, you know, nothing can change.
Yeah. The difficult part of this argument, Michael Schellenberger, I think, is that the danger and the concern about that longevity, that 24,000-year lifespan, seems so insoluble, seems so permanent, that it's hard to sort of put that in some sort of proper context, which is, I know, the argument that you're trying to make. So try again.
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty clear when you look at both immediate risks and death tolls, injuries from every other energy source, and you compare it to, you know, you kind of get this. I mean, I think it's part of the fear that gets constructed around this, kind of like, it's future. We don't know what it is. You know, it's it'll always be here. You know, something could happen. I mean, Davey here, he says terrorism and wars. I mean, suddenly you start kind of bringing in all the kind of the sum of all fears around this thing.
Terrorism isn't a fantasy.
Hang on one second, Dave. I'll get to you, but yeah. Go ahead and finish, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, you actually kind of go, it's like we have a looming global warming problem. We have a half century, maybe a century to solve this. We're talking about impacts in this century, serious impacts, as opposed to this kind of, 24,000 years from now. I mean, yes, I believe, first of all, I believe that waste is going to become fuel. If you reprocess it like the French, you have hardly any of it.
Hardly any waste.
Hardly any waste.
Well,
please share me yours. I mean,
the massive waste from reprocessed fuel is more. It is at a lower level of radioactivity.
Let's get in one more caller, and then I'm going to ask you both for your final thoughts. Ralph, go ahead with your question, please.
Good morning. It's an important discussion, but a lot of this is rather silly because by far the greatest gains you will ever get is by trying to be more efficient about things rather than trying to focus on production side of things. Unfortunately, it's a difficult thing to ask people to do, you know, especially in America, is to try and be more efficient about their use of energy. And then the other comment I have is a lot of people are saying, or at least a lot of the callers calling in, are saying things that are just not correct. I mean, I wish people would do a little more reading and understand physics a little more before they say it.
Ralph,
I mean, the guy talking about...
Yeah, I'm going to hold you there, Ralph, because we're almost out of time, but it's a fair point. And I actually do want to both ask you last for your homework recommendations and to try to put this in some sort of thoughtful context. Ralph makes an interesting point, both that we all need to be efficient, but that we all need to be smart. So, Dave Hamilton, first, what's your recommendation for how people can be the smartest they can be about understanding this issue and putting it in the proper context?
I say I agree, do your homework, but I think from a policy standpoint and from a personal standpoint, we need to do the cheapest, cleanest, quickest, safest things first. We need to focus on reducing energy waste. We need to work to build the cleanest energy sources we can that have the least cumulative risk and cost. And that if we do that first, we can then figure out what the shortfall is, what do we need. You know, do we need carbon capture and storage? Do we need nuclear power? But that those are the alternatives we should do after we pursue the cleanest, quickest options.
Dave Hamilton, thanks. Michael Schellenberger.
I mean, I think we just need to keep this larger perspective in context. You know, the world is going to use 2 to 3 times more energy over the next 40 years, regardless of how efficient we become in the United States. The world needs cheap, clean power. That means that we have to make existing renewables a lot cheaper, but we also need to scale up safe and clean nuclear power.
And no matter how efficient we're going to be, as our last caller was saying, we'll still have that need?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, if you use energy more efficiently, what we find throughout history is that you end up using much more of it.
Michael Schellenberger, president of the Breakthrough Institute. Thanks for being with us, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Dave Hamilton, director of Global Warming and Energy Programs for the Sierra Club. Dave, thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Christina Russo. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.